All right, well, hello everyone. It's a few days now after the end of the Art of Imperfect Action event at the weekend. If you were a part of that live or if you caught up via the recordings, thank you very, very much. I deeply appreciate it. As promised, I said that I would make an attempt to answer a bunch of the questions, the really excellent questions that so many of you asked during the event that I didn't get to during the event itself. I'm still not going to be able to do more than a small portion of them because there were so many great ones, but I've tried to sort of group them, look at themes that recurred, and so that's what I'm going to do here. It's going to be very stream of consciousness. I don't have my full filming setup. I'm just using the webcam. Don't have my amazing producers who are making the event run so smoothly. It's just me and some thoughts in response to some of your questions. So hopefully this is useful. Here goes. First one I wanted to address is from Charles Rice. Several years ago, after a long period of being stuck and immobilized by significant overwhelm with critical project deadlines bearing down on me, I tried the just do one simple thing approach. Then do another, load the dishwasher, fold the laundry. Initially, it made me feel better, but I soon found that I became a simple tasks junkie, looking for more and more simple tasks to complete and avoiding the critical project pile. How does one avoid that trap? I thought this was an interesting question to address because it brings sort of two different things that I talk about into tension or productive, I hope, conflict with each other. One of them is this whole idea that it's incredibly useful, especially when you're facing overwhelm or a kind of motivational meltdown, to radically narrow your task horizon, your time horizon, and just to think in terms of what is the very next thing that I could do, that I'm willing to do, that would make some difference to my reality. And that is where this idea of just do one thing and cross it out comes back, right? This is the idea of, just in case you didn't catch it, it's, you know, you get a notebook, write down some task on the first line that you can do right now that's going to make some difference to your world. Do it, cross it out, write another task on the line below. Do that task, cross it out, keep going. It's kind of silly in a way. It's kind of ridiculous that we as intelligent functional adults should need such a system perhaps, but I do sometimes anyway. And I think it's really a very useful way of getting rid of all that nonsense about what are my plans, how does this fit into my schedule. It's just like, okay, I'd like to get back into the swing of meaningful action. But then you have to set that against the thing that I sometimes call the importance trap, this idea that it can be incredibly tempting, as the questioner points out here, to get into the groove of just doing little things for the kick of having done them and using that to avoid the big tasks and thus systematically postponing the things that you really care about. I think the answer is simply that you need to develop a taste for breaking your very big projects down into these small, doable chunks in such a way that you can integrate them into some kind of system, like just doing one thing and crossing it out. In some sense, this is, you know, time-honored advice, isn't it, to break big projects down into small chunks. But I think it really helps to specifically ask what doneness would look like in each case. So just as you can fold the laundry and you know when it's done and you did it, just as you can load the dishwasher, know when it's done, you did it, you can always do that with even the biggest projects. Once you've broken them down into small chunks, you can know when you have written 200 words of a book chapter, to pick an example from my work. You can know when you have sent a critical email that's an essential part of some major project. And if you can't see how to do this, as a last resort, you can always just use time portions, right? You can always just say, I'm going to do 10 minutes on this project, and when the 10 minutes is complete, that counts as completion. Because there's nothing, no project, you know, building empires, winning American presidential campaigns, there's nothing that can't be broken down ultimately into 10 minutes and then 10 minutes and 10 minutes, because life is just a matter of 10-minute periods followed by more 10-minute periods. So at the very least, that's how to break those tasks down into small chunks. Then you might like to consider taking those and not just doing one thing at a time, but perhaps widening your time horizon a bit and writing down maybe six things that you're going to do. And some of them should be related to these big projects. So maybe you're going to mix three little tasks with three little tasks that don't really relate to a scary project with three little tasks that do. Maybe you're going to alternate between them. And that way you can sort of lull yourself into this way of working that takes what's so good about the just one thing at a time approach and sort of weaves it into the work that you have to do that isn't so appetizing. And I just want to say that I think very quickly, in my experience anyway, you get a taste for these small victories that are part of big projects. It becomes really satisfying, not only to get the boost of having ticked something off, but also the boost of knowing that that thing was related to something you really cared about. And you can make that sort of semi-addictive in a way. It isn't a question of just plowing through and having to do your duty or something like that. Okay, so another question from Janet Johnson. What do you think about keeping on trying? I'm a writer. I don't plan, but I'm pretty convinced that I should try planning just to see if and how it works for me. But I never seem to get around to it. I just keep on buying craft or advice books and never getting around to reading or studying them. Should I keep trying or accept that my process works for me? I'm not sure I trust that it really does. Or maybe let go of wanting to try something new, something else. This is a really interesting one that I resonate with as a writer myself, and I think it brings up a few interesting points. One is that although I think there are times when it's important to let go of wanting to try a new system, I think there are many times when it's actually important to let go of trying to eradicate the desire to keep trying new systems, which is a slightly convoluted way of saying that if poking around with new systems for doing your work is something that just seems to run along with how you do your work and give you little boosts of inspiration here and there and boosts of energy, if it doesn't massively get in the way of you doing your work, then I first of all want to say that I don't think there's anything at all wrong with having that as one track in your life. Yeah, I'm always tinkering. I'm always looking for new things to try. And even the question here mentions buying craft advice books and not reading them. I mean, obviously the point of a book of craft advice is that you read it and benefit in some way from what's in it. But there's also kind of nothing totally wrong with having the odd eccentric thing that you do if it feeds into your practice, I would say. So this idea of buying an advice book and not reading it reminds me of something I do, which is that I buy kind of fancy stationery and then I start using it. And then long before that particular notebook is filled up, I end up moving on to some other piece of fancy stationery. And obviously that looks, and it is on some level, like somebody desperately trying to find the perfect notebook and being perpetually dissatisfied. But I've just sort of come to think of that as something that I do. And if the cost in money and time of doing that is very modest relative to my situation, which I think it is, really. I'm not buying the notebooks don't cost £100 and I'm not buying them every day. I'm talking about, you know, on a longer time scale than that and at a lower price than that. I just see that as something that I do that seems to go along with me doing my work well. And so it's just a cost of doing business, just as much as, you know, the subscription that I have to pay to Zoom to run events like the one that we did at the weekend. So I wouldn't beat yourself up for buying books and not reading them if it's kind of a non-problematic, you know, one of the eccentricities that gets you through. That said, I do just want to say about trying alternative ways of running your work, because the questioner writes here about, you know, thinking that she ought to try planning and actually that she's not convinced that she's got the best method as it stands. And then here I just want to sing the praises once again of the idea of the experimentation period, the buffer zone. I think that what holds people back very often from trying new ways of working is some version of the feeling that they don't want to mess with success. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. They don't want to make things worse by changing everything. They're not confident. I mentioned this in the event. They're not confident that that they can stick with this new way of working forever and therefore they don't even want to begin. And here I think there's tremendous power in literally putting a note in your diary, in your calendar, a week from now, 2 weeks from now, to sort of prompt you to review your working methods. And then between now and that time, to try planning. To try planning if you're not a planner. To try planning less if you're a huge overplanner. Safe in the knowledge that this barrier is coming up, this buffer in your calendar that will remind you, oh, is this really working? And of course, you know, by the time you get there, you're probably either very comfortable with a new way of working or you've abandoned this new way of working. You don't really need that signal in your calendar. I call it a buffer. Buffer is the wrong word for it, actually. Anyway, the point being that you can know right now that you don't need to worry that this isn't going to be forever. You don't need to worry if it's going to sort of send you off on a terrible alternative track. You're just experimenting and you can allow yourself in that sort of contained space to experiment with it. Okay, one more question here from Stephen Nock. I get the idea of facing up to our finitude and doing what really matters. But how do you find out what really matters to oneself? This is the kind of question that comes up a lot. And I always have an answer to it that seems slightly evasive, and it's a sort of a developing answer. So this is a new version of this answer, and maybe it'll be more useful than before. When I was writing 4,000 Weeks, I really wanted to avoid, and I tried to avoid it in things like the masterclass at the weekend too, I really want to avoid giving people a laundry list of telling them the kinds of things that I think are meaningful to do in life, because I think it's so subjective. And I also, more to this question, want to avoid anything too formulaic or prescriptive in terms of how to find that meaning, because I think even that personal quest for your meaning and what matters to yourself is so specific, the way to go about it, that that I don't want to sort of tell other people how to do it. I also think that it's almost always a matter of thinking about the idea that on some level you know, and there might be some things in the way of you knowing, rather than that you don't know yet and you've got to learn some methods for discovery. That's really one of my big problems with the whole sort of discover your purpose line in personal development work. I think that one of the things I'm trying to do in everything I do, but especially the book 4,000 Weeks, is to just sort of clear away a fog. And to say, like, are these mistaken thoughts and mistaken beliefs, are they getting in the way of you just using time meaningfully in the way that you naturally otherwise would if these things weren't in the way? So in a sense, once the fog is cleared, I kind of feel like it's not my job to tell you what you find there. But this is just a long way of saying that you should trust the feeling that you're doing something meaningful. Whenever that occurs in your life, even if it's only occasionally, the feeling that you were in the right place for a few hours or a day, the feeling of sort of deep pleasure, deep fun that comes with certain activities, you should basically have a lot of trust in that. If you really want me to get more specific, then I'm going to mention again a question that I've talked about a lot, which comes from James Hollis, the Jungian psychotherapist, who suggests that we ask about our lives and the choices we face in life the question, does this path enlarge me or diminish me? Can I feel that I'm sort of growing as a person on this path, as opposed to kind of shrinking as a person? And what I love about this question is that it sort of sidetracks the idea of whether something makes you happy. I think feeling pleasure in the moment in an activity is a very good sign that it's close to something that deeply matters to you. But asking yourself, well, will this path make me happy in the future, or am I on route to happiness, is a disastrous question, because as all the research shows, we're terrible at predicting what makes us happy. It's not even certain to me that happiness per se should be the goal of life that we're shooting for here. And so there's this kind of idea that comes from James Hollis that perhaps instead what we should be doing is asking whether we can feel that something is making us bigger as people. And what's so great about that is it makes you see that, you know, it enables you to distinguish between two kinds of negative experience, right? That it may be that you're not really enjoying a job or a relationship or a creative pursuit at the moment. And that might be because it's something that you need to get out of and it's kind of causing your soul to shrivel. Or it might be that actually it's the kind of suffering that is associated with growth, with getting better at that job or getting deeper into that relationship or getting more practiced at that creative pursuit. And that question of enlargement versus diminishment often enables you to tell the difference between those two, I think. All right, moving on. This is a question from Joe Bratley, which I'll summarize. One of the sessions was labeled The Arsonist's Guide to Burning Your Bridges, but I can't really recall you discussing anything that would fit under burning bridges. As a people pleaser, to a fault, it's something I would benefit from discussing, so I would love to hear your thoughts. Yeah, so on the one hand, I think this is a very legitimate, very politely expressed criticism of the way that the material was organized, that part of the event. I use this phrase, burning bridges, and I think that I've sort of reflected on it and written and talked about it sufficiently that I've slightly lost touch with the fact that in ordinary usage, it means specifically those sort of grandiose moments when you take an action that shuts some door forever to you. It makes the possibility of a particular working relationship in the future completely impossible, or you leave a job in sort of fractious circumstances in a place that you can, in a context that you can never go back. It's those sort of big decisions that you can't go back from. Now, what I want to say, and this is the sort of, this is the part which is more in my defense of using this in this term, I guess, is that actually there's a mistake in thinking that burning your bridges only refers to those willed, grand gesture moments in life. That actually there's an important sense in which we are always burning bridges in every single moment, that every single time we decide to use any portion of time for anything, we are automatically failing to use it for other things. And that means that you are always letting certain opportunities wither in a way that they will never recover. You are always letting certain friendships wither in a way that it's going to be hard or impossible to bring them back to life. And you're doing it precisely because you are putting your energy into other friendships, other relationships, other professional opportunities. So it's just baked in to being human and being finite in a world of potentially infinite possibilities. It's just baked in that you're always sort of failing on a whole lot of fronts. That's just the price of succeeding on any fronts. So purpose of talking in this way is to try to convey how ultimately relaxing it is, right? How ultimately relaxing it is to see that keeping all your options open was never on the table to begin with. Just because you are in time and being born forward, as it were, on the river of time, you're always closing down options and you don't have any say in that matter. So the only question is, given the fact that you can only focus on a few things, a few people, a few opportunities, which for now are you going to focus on and allow yourself to let the others go? In the specific context of people pleasing, and this is something that I've certainly grappled with, right? I've got a long history of feeling that if somebody somewhere is disappointed with me or cross or wishes I could have done something differently or had made time for them or something, that this is absolutely terrible, absolutely disastrous. Instead of what I think it is ultimately, which is just a sort of unfortunate flip side of being a finite human trying to do anything decent in the world. It's been really helpful for me, I realize this might not apply to the questioner or to any other specific person, but it's been really helpful for me to get involved in this kind of world of email newsletters and live events and all these kinds of things where you're dealing with a sufficient number of people that it's just inevitable some of them are not going to be pleased with what you do. You know, my email newsletter is growing in a wonderful, pleasing way in terms of numbers of subscribers. But every time I send one out, there's a chunk of people who unsubscribe because they saw what I had to offer and they didn't want it, right? So you, in a sense, you have to get over people pleasing a little bit in that way. But I guess I'm just bringing that up to say that it's sort of like that for everybody, whether that happens to be the nature of your work or not. You have already failed, I guess, to bring up another theme from elsewhere in the event. You have already failed to please everybody that you could in principle please. You have already experienced, I'm sure, somebody being disappointed or cross or offended by something you did or said or failed to do. And you have seen with your own eyes and from your own provable experience that it was not the end of the world, that you lived to fight another day. So I think it's a question of paying close attention and maybe even taking sort of baby steps in terms of displeasing people, right? I'm not expecting anybody to tell their boss that they're not going to work on the most important project that the organization has at the moment. But there may be some other specific requests being made of you, say in your life outside work, where you can just experiment step by step with taking a specific sort of bridge burning action or just a sort of no, saying no action, and monitoring what happens and whether it's really as bad as all that. I know it's a really difficult thing. I don't want to make it sound easy. I know there are sort of reasons of cultural conditioning where it may be easier for me to say as a man than if I were a woman, things like that. But that's what I think it has to start with, that understanding that we already are only doing a tiny number of the things we could ever do in principle. We're already not pleasing most of the people we could ever please in principle. All right, question from Kate Graham. To slow down and be okay with not doing everything seems all fine and good, but it's also hard to square this with how differently the people around you act and the corresponding success that they have. And wonder if you should be working harder or if you're not working hard enough. How do you think about this? Well, this question of how you pursue any of the ideas or the philosophy that we were discussing at the weekend when other people around you are not doing it is a really interesting one to me. And I have a couple of things to say about it. But before I say those two things, I just want to question the premise of this question, which I take as saying that, you know, people who are not slowing down and not trying to do everything, people who are not slowing down and who are trying to do everything have, quote, corresponding success. I don't think there's any reason to believe from any evidence I've ever seen, any personal experience I've ever had, that the people who rush and do not try to limit what they're doing, get more done, get it done more effectively, have more success. If they do have a lot of success, it's just as likely to be in spite of those habits of rushing and those habits of sort of embracing being overwhelmed and super busy all the time. So I don't think we should start from the assumption in any way that any of what I'm talking about here is likely to be associated with less success or less output or less making a difference or meaningful impact on the world. I don't buy that at all. Okay, that said, first of all, I think it's important to see that, you know, if we're learning any skills here, if I'm suggesting that it's worth cultivating any skills, sort of, it is precisely the skill of being able to keep your head while all around you are losing theirs, as it were, right? It is precisely the skill of tolerating those thoughts and that anxiety that says, well, like, can I get away with this? This is weird. People are going to judge me. I can't trust that this is the right way to work because I'm not having it endorsed. I'm not having it sort of reinforced by how people around me are working. That is the skill, that ability to do this a little bit anyway. And of course, it's going to differ from situation to situation. And there are people who might be more effective at all their work and all their lives if they left work at 4 p.m. who would be fired if they didn't stay at their desks till 6 p.m. Like, I get it. Everyone is always going to have to navigate the real circumstances of their situation. But I think it's really important not to make any of these ways of working sort of dependent on the idea that eventually circumstances are going to make them easy, but to see that doing it anyway, to whatever extent is practical in your situation, is the challenge. And, you know, that might be something as small as, going off to a meeting room in the building on your own and spending 10-15 minutes sitting with a problem because the sort of team situation that you're in the rest of the time requires you to never sit with problems but always to race forward to solutions. I don't know. I'm making this up. It's a question of adapting the ideas to the reality, obviously. But I think it's that important internal psychological move that sort of refuses to go along with the assumption that rush and overwhelm and trying to do everything is the answer. That's the first step. And you can sort of secede from the culture internally in that way, no matter how far you can embody that in your day-to-day actions in the external world, right? It may be that a lot of it for now has to be internal and can't manifest itself in action. It's still going to give you a measure of freedom, because you're going to be in touch with the truth about human finitude instead of deceiving yourself. And then the only other thing I'd add here is that I think it can be really, really useful to compare, not compare yourself with other people, but to compare your own productivity and output when you're in these two different mindsets of, you know, embracing finitude, trying to cultivate active patience, trying to deliberately not try to do everything, versus the more conventional one. And keeping a done list is one of the ways of doing this, right? Just a simple way of monitoring what you get through. But if there's any way in your work, it would depend on your specific work, if there's any way that you can measure, you know, okay, I'm just gonna pursue this new way of working, I'm going to try to pursue it for a couple of weeks, and then I'm going to look back at those 2 weeks and see what I actually produced, how many of my projects I completed, how many of my goals I met. I really do bet you're going to find that it is a more effective way of working, as well as a more peaceful and satisfying way of working. So I think it's useful to try to set up some kind of metric that's appropriate to your life, just to prove to yourself that you don't get less done this way. You don't get less of the important stuff done this way. And that from there, you can really build the faith that it's a way of working that is worth carrying on with, I think. Here's a question about the 3-3-3 method of structuring the day that I spoke about. And the question comes from Anders Gar. Could you clarify? You say 3-3-3 underestimates your work schedule, but since we always overestimate what we can do, this means we might actually get through this schedule. I think that's what you mean. But I can imagine some of us, me, thinking, oh, this is an underestimate, so in the end I should get through more than that. I'm not going to go through the whole details in this recording of the 3-3-3 method, because if you are hearing this, you ought to have access to the recordings and the slides from the main two sessions. And I just want to reinforce again that I know people love to get like the specific instructions they ought to follow, but for me it is really important not to go too far in that direction and to say that 3-3-3 is one example of a way of structuring your day. I invite you to experiment with others. What I invite you to do is to experiment with others that follow the same principles as 3-3-3, rather than necessarily copying the exact same tactics. And one of those principles which the questioner talks about here is that it underestimates he says work schedule. What I mean by the idea that it's an underestimate is that it is not it's not an attempt to make a place in the day for everything that you feel you need to get done in the day, and as a result it's not a system for organizing your day where everything has to go perfectly for it to work. So for example, if you normally have, I'll take my own case, right? I very normally have maybe 7-8 discretionary hours of time in the day when the rhythms of family and other things don't sort of dictate basically what I'm going to be doing. So I never plan when I'm trying to structure those 7 or 8 hours. I never plan what I think is going to be 7 or 8 hours worth of activity, because I just know myself. I know Hofstadter's law, which I discussed in the event, and I want the wins, right? So I want to do. I want to aim to do an amount of work that I can do in 4 hours or 3 hours, and then if there's extra time, great, I got plenty I need to be getting on with. But I'm not making my sense of self-worth or my happiness or peace of mind dependent on everything, on hitting every single mark that day, because that's going to so rarely happen. And look, I think you're right that you're going to be haunted by the thought that you should get through more than that, right? I mean, the way I use this system, or a version of it anyway, is precisely to pick something in my sort of core work that I want to complete today, in that sort of 3 hours of real core focus. And every time I pick one of those things, I'm thinking like, well, there's another 6 things that really, you know, it would be great to have done by the end of today in that domain. The point of 333 is not to get rid of that thought or to solve that problem, because that problem is the human condition. It is to provide a way of working with structure that sort of accommodates that fact, right? So the idea that you're going to get through everything that needs doing is sort of in denial of reality. The idea that you can pick something that does need doing and you're still going to feel like there's plenty more you should have got done, that's in tune with reality, in tune with the reality that we have a limited amount of time, that we tend to massively underestimate how long things will take, and that we have these mental worlds in which we're totally capable of yearning to do so much more than a day can hold. So it's sort of trying to, I hope this is clear, it's sort of trying to allow for that and say, yeah, that feeling is probably not going to go away, but don't let that feeling that you ought to do 100,000 things dictate a really counterproductive and despair-inducing way of structuring your day, where you try to make time for all those things, right? Just sort of allow the feeling and meanwhile get on with, you know, some real practical victories that you can repeat day after day after day in order to make serious progress. That said, I do think that if you follow a method like this for a while, you find that sort of, oh, I should have done more feeling will dissipate, will evaporate a little bit, because it will be sort of crowded out or outweighed by the fact that you see that you are in fact doing all these other things, the things you're actually getting done in the course of the day. I think time and again, we can really do something very therapeutic to our thoughts about productivity by letting ourselves have a chance to make real modest progress on things, to offset the fantasies of massive but fundamentally not real progress that we're feeling we should make. If you can spend a week sort of knocking off some really important chunks of a project you're working on, that sort of strange mental fantasy that says, like, really, I ought to have done 10 times as much, it will lose its force, because you know, because there's something real happening in the world of the concrete, and real change, real transformation, real meaningful output, even if it's modest, is always infinitely more valuable than the largest possible amounts of output, transformation, or change that only exist in the realm of fantasy. Okay, Katrina Thorstensen asks, I have so much trouble transitioning between tasks. I have so much trouble starting, and then once I start, I have trouble sticking to the committed time frame. And then once I'm done or need to move on, I'm so surprised I actually did the work. I can't imagine doing it all over again with something else, so I end up procrastinating again. Yeah, I resonate with this. It is part of the reason that I talk about stopping practice when we were talking about the art of active patience. The idea that actually there is a skill one needs to learn that is not just getting started, which is very troublesome, as Katrina points out here, but also a skill of stopping. if you decide that you're going to do 15 minutes work on some incredibly intimidating project, there is real benefit in learning to stop when those 15 minutes are up. And there's lots of different ways of explaining why I think that's helpful. But one of them is that you're sort of keeping a promise to yourself, right? You're saying, like, I'm going to do 15 minutes on this. If you do 15, if you say that to yourself, and then when it gets to 15 minutes, you keep going and going and going, you've sort of broken the promise with yourself. And some part of you doesn't trust the other part. And it sort of makes everything into a big drama, because next time when you sit down to do 15 minutes, there's part of you that's thinking that, in fact, you have to tackle this whole project at a much grander scale. So really, really learning the art of working on something for a very short time and then stopping. And absolutely, gradually start increasing those times as you get into the groove. I'm not saying only work on things for 10 minutes for the rest of your life. There are lots of benefits in getting absorbed into a task as well. But if you find it difficult to transition between tasks, if you find it difficult to start again once you've done something, I would really see what happens if you do that first task for 5 minutes, 10 minutes. When the time stops, when the time comes to stop, use a timer if that's helpful. Get up, go and do something for 5 minutes, take a break. Do the next task. Again, try to limit the time, or maybe you're chipping away at one big task, however it works. The point about the stopping is that, for slightly mysterious reasons, although I tried to explain it just then and I've explained it in some other ways, but for slightly mysterious reasons, this will actually make it more appealing for most people, I think, to get started in on a task again. There's something really beneficial about learning to stop. Question from David Furman. This is a question about how much leeway or flexibility to give yourself. For example, I love the way doing morning pages makes me feel, but I couldn't do them in the morning each day, and I started calling them daily pages, but then that became irregular over time. I want to do it every day, but I put it off. In such a situation, does it make sense to stick to a specific time container, as Susan Piver calls them, or just accept that it doesn't happen every day? So I guess on the abstract level, these kinds of questions about the balance between structure and freedom always come down to me wanting to say that obviously the answer here is whatever works, right? And that might seem obvious, but I think it's something worth dwelling on for a moment, because it really has to be the measure of everything, right? So on some level, you want to try to test this out. If doing it daily-ish, to quote one of the tactics I mentioned from Dan Harris, if thinking of it as daily-ish is the thing that gets the most morning or daily pages done and has the most effect on your life, then that's the answer. If really trying hard to make sure that it happens at a certain time every day turns out to be the one that works, then that's the answer. Don't fall for the idea that if a way of doing things feels gentler on yourself, it must be worse. It's very possible that the idea of going a little easier on yourself is going to be the more effective one, because you're not going to get caught up in sort of fighting against it and resenting it. That said, on this specific issue of daily routines, I will mention something that I think I did mention in the event already, which is the idea of a no later than time. I've found this quite useful. It's very incompatible with family life with a small child for me to say that I will always begin work at 8 in the morning, right? Sometimes I can do that and sometimes I just can't. But it's a lot more practical to say that basically every day I will begin work no later than 9:15, no later than 9:30. That feels like a rule that can support me. It can prevent me from dawdling and, you know, not quite getting started. It can do all the good things that a specific start time can do. But it doesn't create this problem of, like, 3 days out of five, I'm going to be defeated because of things that happen in life and that I wouldn't even want to not have in my life. Like, you know, the rhythms of, you know, my son needing my attention or something. So no later than time that's quite generous is something that you can, like, you can still navigate by that time, but you don't make it one that really, you know, it's not one that holds you to a very hard to achieve schedule. And you would expect most days on this basis to have done it by then. So for example, if your life allows it, you could say, I want to always have these morning pages done by 10:30 in the morning. Obviously depends on your professional situation and all that stuff. And then hopefully many days they're going to be done by 7:30 in the morning, but you're not going to have lost or failed according to your system if they're not. The other thing I've found really useful in terms of fitting around family rhythms is the idea of a running order. So I tend to say now in terms of my morning routine that there are 3 or 4 things I want to do. I want to read for a short period. I want to write in my morning pages. And I want to do a short period of meditation. And I want to do them in that order. But I am not making any promises with myself that I'm going to do them all before it's time to make my son's breakfast or do the school run or something. Like, ideally, they're all done before anyone in the house wakes up. But the point of keeping them in this order is just that other things can come and interrupt, and then I know what I'm going back to later. So maybe I get up and I do the reading and I'm halfway through the morning pages, and then I have to put that aside. Okay, well, I know that the next bit of time that comes up is to finish the morning pages and do the meditation. And again, all usual caveats. If you have a job where you absolutely have to start focusing on the work at 8:30 every day, there's a limit to how far this can stretch. But it's just an example of bringing some order and some structure to a day, holding yourself to a certain kind of discipline without the kind of absolutist thing that it's so tempting to do and that just endlessly sets you up for a sense of having failed. So I hope that might be of some help. All right, so I just wanted to briefly address a kind of question that came up a few times, and it does come up fairly often, and I'll sort of bunch it all together into one question instead of going through the individual ones. And this is the question along the lines of saying, well, look, this is all very well, this approach, this philosophy, these tactics, when it comes to an individual person, when it comes to maybe your life outside work, your personal creative practice, or if you're a self-employed solopreneur person. But what about all of us who work in organizational and corporate cultures that are not on board with these ideas? How do you make them work in that context? How do you spread them? How do you sort of deal with these ideas when people around you are not reinforcing them because they're still on board with the idea that you should try to do absolutely everything, get more and more efficient, get ever more overwhelmed, and drive yourself to burnout? Got sort of 3 answers to this question, and I'll go very quickly through each one. The first, of course, is that whatever actual influence or control you have over an organizational culture in which you're in, you can become an evangelist for these ideas. So if you're the boss and you're the person who decides whether a day spent on a team building exercise is going to be spent paintballing or doing something else, you can decide that it's going to be spent doing the 3-hour painting viewing exercise that I talk about at length in 4,000 weeks. The sort of experience, which I think can be very bonding, of going through that discomfort and finding out what comes as a result of going through that kind of discomfort, that kind of thing you can just choose to do. If you are in charge of how work is assigned and how goals and targets are set in an organization, you can be much more explicit about, you know, what's going to go on the back burner if this thing is going to go on the front burner. You can bring forth and make explicit the trade-offs that are involved, instead of this kind of thing you see in many, many organizational contexts where so-called schemes of prioritization and goal setting are just really there to try to persuade the senior leadership to believe that everything is going to get done at once, and it isn't, and it doesn't get done. So there's all sorts of ways in which you can do that if you have that kind of influence. If you are a person who, from your sort of senior position, can make it clear to people that you don't think that there's some great benefit in them staying till 7 p.m. per se, if actually the results that they're getting are going to be better pursued more incrementally and stopping earlier in the day, you know, you can pass along those messages. okay, if you don't have that kind of control or influence in an organization, the second thing I wanted to say is that it still really truly is my contention here that many of these tactics and ways of working will just produce better work by you in your organization and at a faster rate. So I am really saying that, you know, giving yourself time to rest in uncertainty and have the patience to let solutions to problems emerge rather than trying to sort of bear down on everything and fix it and get it all done. To give one example, again, drawing from the active patience module, I am saying that that leads to better and over the long term, faster results, right? So I am saying that you should do that even if it requires a kind of a certain kind of friction, psychological friction between you and the people around you. I am saying that if you can focus on one major project at a time, if you possibly can do that, whatever you claim you're doing in your sort of public facing life in the organization, it is still going to lead to those things getting done more reliably and ultimately over the long haul faster. So all of these things that we discussed in the two sessions, I still think they work as individual practices, even if they're sometimes going to generate some sort of sense of being out of step with everyone around you. And then the third thing, I think, is just to say that even if you really can't make those changes, and this relates to some things I was saying earlier, but even if you can't make any changes in what you do because you work in an environment that is so rigid and so sort of dictatorial in terms of how it makes you assign your time and handle your workflow, you still can achieve a certain kind of inner psychological freedom and independence by understanding that you are always only doing one thing at a time anyway, that you will never get to the end of an effectively infinite to-do list. There is a measure of peace of mind that comes from this, even to the person who, through misfortune of circumstance, can do almost nothing about it on the outside. And then to sort of wrap all those three up, I would just say, you know, we're talking about things that are true anyway, right? So if I take something from someone senior in the organization to me and I make it my focus now, there are going to be trade-offs. Those trade-offs exist and things are going to get neglected in order that this key focus can be focused on. That's going to happen. It's not a question of deciding to neglect things or be more neglectful. It's a question of seeing more clearly what is already happening. And therefore, you know, if that is what's going to happen, in most corporate cultures that I have any experience of anyway, there would be some openness to being explicit about that and to drawing people's attention to the fact that you're going to have to, you know, decelerate on something in order to accelerate on something else. And I think that if people can, you know, be evangelists for this perspective in whatever, to whatever degree they really can, it's going to be clear to anyone who takes this stuff on board that it does lead to better results, right? It isn't just, although it's incredibly important to be relaxed and peaceful and have a humane and approach to people's working lives. It isn't just for that, right? These are ways of acting and of being that are more in tune with how things really are with respect to time. And therefore, in the long run, they cannot fail to deliver better results. All right, so here's a question from Deborah Rubian. Any thoughts about how to prioritize, how to select the next task when it feels like many different things are time sensitive and important? Not like yesterday's example where every option looks equally good, but where choosing one means not choosing another and all seem to need to happen now. This is a good question. Gets me onto one of my favorite topics, which is urgency and how to think about it. So here are a few thoughts. The first is that I'm not sure I quite agree that this kind of dilemma about two things that seem to need to happen now is all that different from the one where two options seem equally good or meaningful. I think that Fredkin's paradox still applies. In other words, if you feel that there are two different uses for the next hour or the next day, that both are really strong contenders in terms of urgency for being what you do with that time, then although that feels like a very fraught situation, considered rationally, if you're able to do that, it's actually a really easy situation. It doesn't matter. You might as well toss a coin, right? Because if you've really established that they're both extremely important to get done, then doing either of them is a meaningful use of your finite attention and your finite time. That said, I think urgency is a special case as well, because we tend to give it this kind of force majeure power, right? It seems like if something's urgent, then it just wins the day. And as I wrote in a newsletter recently, I think it's useful to consider an alternative to that. One of the things that comes up a lot in the personal development literature is the Eisenhower matrix, this little 2x2 square that tries to characterize tasks by whether they are important or unimportant, and urgent or not urgent. And I sort of went on a whole rant about how one of those quadrants, which is urgent but not important tasks, is a very bizarre concept, right? It's very bizarre to think that a task could have no urgency. Sorry, a task could have no importance, but also be incredibly urgent. And I think that, I won't go through that whole piece of writing, but I think that where that can lead us is to an understanding that urgency isn't something separate from importance. Urgency is a kind of importance. And when you are weighing up what to do among the range of options, you're going to take account of urgency, but you're also going to take account of other forms of importance, like whether something is fun, whether something is building value for you, whether something is making a difference to other people, whether something is a meaningful way to spend your time on a million different other axes. And then urgency is actually just best understood as one of those things. So what that does, apart from anything else, is it just cuts urgency down to size, and it helps you to see that a lot of the time, a task that feels urgent has that kind of feeling of life or death, when in fact it's not life or death, right? There's a whole range of things which are not going to lead to us becoming destitute or being fired or damaging irreparably very, very important relationships if we don't do them on that urgent scale. So that is just a question of like turning down the dial of urgency a bit. But I don't want to deny that once you've done that, there are still tasks that are really, really important to do on a time-sensitive basis. And sometimes you can have more of those to do with a day or an hour than you have the capacity to do. Well, the first thing to say about that is there is a baseline level of maths here, right? Or math, if you're an American listener. If there are two things you absolutely have to do with the next hour that are both incredibly, incredibly urgent, and you can only realistically do one of them, then the bad thing that results from not doing the other one is going to happen, right? This is not me saying you should be able to let this happen, or it's not going to be a big deal if you let it happen. It's just like, it's going to happen. That's just how the situation works. I think, fortunately, almost all of us are very rarely in that situation, but it absolutely can happen. And then it's just a question of reconciling yourself to something really, really bad happening. I think that is really rare. And I think that day by day, the way to think about clashing urgent priorities is basically just to pick one that feels important in other ways too, right? If you face a choice between two options and one of them feels really urgent, but the other one feels really urgent and its contribution to some long-term plan or goal or value is much clearer, then go with that one first. And then just in terms of reconciling yourself to this situation, because that's all it really is, right? I mean, so much of what we're discussing here is about reconciling yourself to the situation that we really are in as finite humans, and then plunging into that life instead of holding back and trying to sort of build conceptual structures to allow us to live a kind of life that's actually impossible for finite humans. Anyway, what you can do there is just to think retrospectively, think back over the last weeks or months of your life. And I've done this and found it very beneficial, right? I very often have become stressed on a morning thinking about how I have to do say, three things that I'm only going to get to do one of, and I have to do all three of them, and there's a lot of stress. Well, what happens is I don't do three of them because that was impossible. I do one. Sometimes some of the others end up being left for days or weeks, and my world did not collapse, right? Things that felt incredibly urgent, once they had been, once I'd got over that hump of how urgent they felt, and I'd put them into the bucket of, you know, things I just need to get through when I can, one after another, actually they lost a lot of that power to stress and freak me out, because it became clear that by neglecting them for a few days, nothing all that bad was going to happen. Now, then, of course, you need to not neglect them entirely and go too far in the other direction and forget about them completely, which is where a solid task management system where you keep a list of the things that are on your plate, that's where that kind of thing comes in handy. But I suppose what I'm saying, and I've been around the houses a bit with this answer, I suppose all that I'm trying to say is that, number one, if you genuinely only have the bandwidth to do one of two seemingly desperately urgent things, then you're only going to do one of them. And the chips are going to have to be allowed to fall where they will in terms of the other one. Number two, it's very often likely the case that at least one of those things that you think of as absolutely needing to be done with the next hour or the next day does not actually absolutely have to be done with the next hour or the next day. You can come to see the effects of not doing it, the consequences of not doing it, as just a cost of doing business, as just a trade-off that you're going to have to make. If I've got to choose between A and B, and A is going to have this set of negative consequences if I fail to do it today, and B is going to have this other set of negative consequences because I fail to do it today, then all I'm doing is deciding which set of negative consequences I would like to deal with, which problem I would like to have. And that's all it's ever going to be. This brings me on to another interesting question, and I just wanted to address this quickly from, actually lost who this is from. I think it was an anonymous asker. And this person asked, your thoughts about gender roles. As a female, most of time is spent thinking about others through parenting, elder care, being a wife, my career as a social worker, etc. I think in general, women are taught to think about others first. Men are not. Thoughts. This is really interesting. I'm going to use it to sort of make a broader point as well, or a sort of more abstract point maybe. But the first thing to say is, yeah, totally. I think that a lot of the things that I'm talking about here, this is a culturally specific point, won't apply to every woman and every man listening to this. But, you know, there are reasons of stereotypes and conditioning and cultural expectations that make a lot of what I'm talking about potentially harder for women to implement in their lives than men. The people-pleasing stuff is an interesting example. I really feel that myself, and I wonder if that's because of Britishness somehow intersecting with the sex question. So I am a man, but on the other hand, I'm British, so I sort of feel that quite intensely. But I'm totally willing to accept that this stuff is often harder for women than men because of cultural expectations. I'm never sure where to go with that point, though, because I think this ties into a point that I'm trying to sort of express in a number of places in the book and elsewhere, which is that, again, we're just talking here when we talk about finitude and the limitation of our own time and energy and bandwidth. We're just talking about a situation that is the case. And when we talk about the gender differences here, we're talking about how it can be harder to face that situation for somebody raised to believe that it's their job to take on board everybody else's concerns, to sort of be a reservoir of, you can just, if something needs doing, this person's job is to find a way to get it done. It can be harder for that person to face up to the underlying reality of finitude because there's more people going to be disappointed or condemnatory or something like that if you don't do everything. But it's still true. And in some other contexts as well, not so much to do with the gendered part of this, people have sometimes said to me, you know, well, okay, that's easy for you to say because you are in this or that position of relative good fortune in terms of, say, your autonomy over your time, or the fact that if you don't get a certain amount of work done on a given day, you're not likely to be completely immediately homeless because you have a certain amount of cushion. And in all these cases, I want to say, number one, yes, totally. And number two, just because something is easy for me to say does not mean that it isn't true. It's just easier for me to say it and acknowledge it. So that's really the thought I want to say about all of this stuff. It's like, I really do think I'm just pointing to truths about the human condition and understanding how a bit more how we can work with those truths, turn them to our advantage, harness them, step more fully into them to live sort of empowered and accomplished and more meaningful lives. That it is easier for some people to do that facing up to due to unfairnesses in society is absolutely true, but doesn't contradict that, I don't think. All right, and just to finish off here, I wanted to take this question from Scott Thompson. Do you have any tactics or strategies for avoiding comparing yourself or your work with others? Now, this obviously goes to the heart of so much of this, right? We are so prone to comparing ourselves and our output with other people and finding them wanting. I think that's come up in one or two of the questions I've addressed here today already. It's a huge and fertile topic, and I just want to say a couple of things about it. The first, and I don't know whether this really amounts to a strategy or a tactic, but let me talk about it anyway, is what I've said elsewhere about how important it is to understand that everyone is winging it all the time, right? So we have this tendency when comparing ourselves to others to think that they are more authoritative, that they are more efficient, that they do better, that they just seem to sail through life without effort. And a big part of the normal conventional advice about imposter syndrome comes down to like, well, so you should try to persuade yourself that you are just as competent and effort and find things just as effortless and are just as qualified as they are. Whereas I always want to say the real important move here is to see that they are just as unqualified and anxious and improvising and making it up as they go along as you are. In other words, everyone is winging it all the time. And there's something very fragile about trying to persuade yourself that actually you're an expert when you don't really believe it. There's something much more resilient and sustainable about understanding that nobody, in this sense anyway, is an expert. Certainly people bring bodies of knowledge to their daily improvisation, but it's still daily improvisation that we are all engaged in. So there's something very empowering about that. I think the way Alan Watts would have put it would be that, you know, it's not that you're not an imposter, it's that we are all imposters and only ever could be, in a sense, putting on a persona while being the sort of, you know, improvisational, prone to all sorts of emotions, ups and downs, complicated beings that we are on the inside. So everyone is winging it all the time, and the only reason that yours is the only inner monologue of self-doubt that you ever hear is because you only ever hear your inner monologues. It isn't because everyone else has no inner monologue of self-doubt. They definitely do, apart from a few people who should do, and you don't want to be like them anyway. The other point to make about comparison is that if you can't completely give up this urge to compare, and I'm not sure anyone can completely give it up, you can at least make some effort to use the right comparisons. You can at least make some effort to figure out what it really makes meaningful sense to compare your output, performance, state of mind to. And that is, in short, not to compare yourself now to some fantasy version of yourself in the future, or yourself now to some fantasy version of other people, which, as just discussed, is a fantasy version because you can't get inside their heads, but rather to compare yourself to yourself retrospectively. And I'll explain what I mean by that. If the person that you're comparing yourself to is a hypothetical version of you that is completely non-anxious, completely non-procrastinatory, completely efficient, completely able to choose, make the right choices in every moment, that bar is effectively infinite. It's never going to be reached. You can always imagine a version of you doing better than now. By definition, it will never stop. Likewise, anytime you think you've reached the level of your peers in some area, you can always imagine that actually they're even better than that or enjoying themselves even more than that. Or you can just nominate a new bunch of peers. That's what usually happens, who you haven't reached, right? So you reach a certain level in your profession, you stop comparing yourself to those people, you just compare yourself to people who are ahead of you. That's an unwinnable game and makes for, you know, misery and no peace of mind and doesn't have any particularly solid impact on your motivation or your output at all. The alternative is to look backwards and compare your output or how you are now or how you cope with challenges to last week or 6 months ago or a year ago. And that is the powerful way to see that you are making progress. That is a question, to quote Susan Piver, of, you know, not looking at how far you've got to go on a journey, but looking at how far you've come. It's the reason for the done list, which I talked about. It's the reason for any kind of measure that you bring to your work that enables you to sort of mark and celebrate progress as it happens by looking back at the distance that you've traveled over any particular time period. And what this does, of course, is it gradually switches the default of who you are comparing yourself to from an unwinnable kind of comparison to a kind of comparison that is eminently winnable, that will show you that you have made progress. Now, there's even here one thing you do have to bear in mind, which is that as you improve at things and as you develop in life and as you grow, which we all do as time goes by, you're going to take on challenges that meet your new level of capacity. You're going to take on challenges that meet your new edge. And I've certainly had this experience, right? I have it with writing, I have it with just productivity in general, staying on top of stuff, you know, which is you figure it out, you do pretty well, you make some progress. But then as a result, of course, some other opportunities come your way. You take on a bigger challenge. You take on something that pushes you a bit further out of your comfort zone. You reach more people with your work, whatever it could be. And so you have to be aware of that issue that actually sometimes it's going to feel the same now as it did a year ago or 5 years ago, precisely because you have made progress and are doing more. And have bitten off more. So when you're comparing yourself with yourself in hindsight, not necessarily a good idea to do it in terms of some vague sense of how life feels, but to really try to record output and accomplishments. One thing I do, if somebody sends me, this is slightly embarrassing to admit, if somebody sends me like a really lovely email that sort of speaks to the difference that some of my work is making or something, I make sure those are kept separately to be looked at again sometime, right? And I don't even particularly go back and look at them, but I know that that's there. It's another kind of measure of progress and of making a difference. I suppose it's a bad example because it does depend on the judgment of other people, and I'm not really talking about that specifically, but just things like the number of words that you have written, the number of the size of a business that you have grown, the skills that you have developed, the things that you could do with your piano playing now that you couldn't have done 5 years ago, anything, right? And it can be incremental, it can be tiny. The point is the comparison is with something where the comparison is meaningful instead of a comparison where you're setting yourself up to be sort of despondent in a systematic way. All right, so I'm going to stop there. I hope some of these answers were useful in some way. And as I say, there were so many other great questions that I didn't have the chance to get to. Once again, I'm really grateful for them all. And thank you very much indeed. Okay, bye.